if we stop to think about it. The book of Psalms holds a very unique place in our life together. And the funny thing is that we seldom do stop to think about the book of Psalms. We read or sing from it every week, and think about how often each of us has likely done that throughout our lives. We read or sing from the book of Psalms every week, but it seldom provides the focus for a sermon, for example. It's kind of an inside joke among preachers that when the gospel of the day is a bit too challenging, either for us or perhaps in our limited judgment for you, let's face it, the gospel sometimes is pretty challenging. We might that day go have a look at the psalm appointed for that day. And when preachers meet, we ask each other, how did Sunday go? And one of us might say, I preached on the psalm. And there is a little wry smile, and the other might say, oh yeah, me too. With that same little wry smile, because, you know, we gave ourselves a little break that day or whatever, or we suspect ourselves of that, or we hold ourselves to that account. But I just want to say, not today. Not today. I'm preaching on the psalm for a reason. The gospel for today is challenging. Am I the only person who found it challenging? It's very challenging on a number of fronts. And I challenge us all, as the passage bids us to do, to aspire to that very high bar of integrity. There is a very high standard of personal and spiritual integrity set out in that passage. I don't think anyone would see that differently. It challenges us to put aside anger, for example, each and every time we come to this altar. Each and every time challenges us to leave it behind. And I really think that that is one of the most helpful opportunities that we avail ourselves of when we come here to any church to take part in the Eucharist, is that opportunity to utterly let go of anger and all things like it. And I would actually sum that up as the deeper message of that passage is really to stay away from all those things, or let go of, once we've been there, let go of all those things that take us to that place of anger or conflict or scandal. Scandal is actually the word used in the passage quite a bit. It's covered up by the fact that it's translated in a bunch of different ways there. But it's a major theme of the gospel, as I think I've preached on quite a bit. You may be actually a bit ready for me to move on to a different theme there. But again, we in spirituality in the brain, for example, back in the fall, we looked at how this is, that our brains are built in such a way that we've got a fear circuit that takes us to that place where we get triggered. And our spiritual practices invite us to aspire to that higher, to teach and aspire and choose that higher cortical activity. It's quite striking that our brains are structured that way, and our spiritual practices lead us and empower us in that resource. So I think that is really a core impact of that passage, an invitation of that passage. And today I want us to stop and think about the book of Psalms, because it is a fantastic resource for prayer and a fantastic resource for us in that aspiration to the higher cortical activity, as the neuroscientists say, to that deeper peace, as Christians say. And as we move into the season of Lent, I'm hoping we can renew our prayer life a bit with a new approach to the Psalms. So while we're stopping to think about the book of Psalms, let's take a look at it as well. I'm hoping you'll have in your pews a copy of this green book, the Book of Alternative Services, in your pew rack in front of you. And if you take that book and turn to page 705, this is the beginning of the book of Psalms. And wow, what a source book this book is. It's a source. It's a deep, deep well of spiritual riches, so full of the spiritual life of its writers, that its cup still runneth over into our lives and for generations to come. This book is old, thousands of years old, and it's a book of songs. There are many songs throughout the Bible in many different books. This is the song book of the Bible from before the birth of Christ. It's 150 psalms written for singing in worship. And it might also be our most familiar book of poems. I'm not absolutely sure if that's true, but I'm kind of testing that idea. Think of the 23rd psalm, for instance. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. I was able to write down those verses from memory, as I think many of us could, in the King James Version, because the book itself is kind of like those green pastures. They restore our souls. Though when we know the Psalms, we know that their waters are not completely untroubled by any means. The Psalms take us to the whole range of human spiritual experience, to the depths of the human heart, and to the heights, and everything in between. And what poems these Psalms are. Familiar as they may be, their form is completely unlike the English poems we know by heart. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. That is the kind of poem we understand. It plays by the rules we know. Its rhythm is simple and regular, with the same four beats per line. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills. And most especially, we recognize it as poetry because it uses end rhyme. Cloud, crowd, hills, daffodils, trees, breeze, but not the Psalms. Although various Psalms don't use end rhyme. Various attempts have been made through the centuries to discover the characteristics of English and European poetry here. But the main formal characteristics of the Psalms are different. The differences in their form are complicated because we read them in English translation from the Hebrew, a language structured in a completely different way from English. And I don't want to dwell on it all too much, all the technicalities, because there's just so much to know about this amazing book. But two characteristics are especially apparent to us. Firstly, the profound faithfulness of the Psalms, their unflagging focus on the word, the law, the presence, and the worship of a single monotheistic, loving God. And secondly, their use of parallelism, the repetition of ideas between halves of the verses in various ways. If you've still got your book open to Psalm 1, you'll see this parallelism right there, right off the top, in verse 1 of Psalm 1. Happy are they who have not walked in the counsel of the wicked, nor lingered in the way of sinners, nor sat in the seats of the scornful. The second half of the verse, after the little asterisk, repeats the idea developed through repetition, the idea expressed in the first half of the verse. And that runs through the book of Psalms in a myriad of ways. And that's a window into the form and the meaning and the power of the Psalms, that repetition. Psalm 119 that we sang earlier is uniquely amazing among the Psalms. Let's take a look at it. It starts on page 868. If you flip through a bit, a couple pages, you'll see that it's really long. At 176 verses, it is the longest psalm in the collection by a considerable margin. But it is 176 verses long, not just because the psalmist had a lot to say and needed 176 verses to say it in. It's more that the writer had something to say about God and about the Word of God, and she figured out a way to say it through a form that took 176 verses to complete. Psalm 119, this psalm, is an acrostic poem. That might not be immediately obvious to us reading it in English translation, but it is an acrostic poem. It has 22 sections because there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and there is one section for each letter, from Aleph to Tav. There are 8 lines in each section because there are 8 terms, 8 words for law or word in the Hebrew language. And each section uses, each of the 22 sections, uses all 8 words, each with their own verse, roughly speaking. So 8 times 22 equals 176 verses. You see the word Aleph at the top in bold under the number 119, because in Hebrew, the first word of each of the 8 verses begins with A or Aleph. Again, that's kind of hidden from us in the English translation. And it's the same with each of the 21 other sections, as you can see. The great discovery of the past 20-odd centuries with the Book of Psalms, though, for both Jews and Christians, is that the Psalms become most powerful when we don't just read them or study them or analyze them, as I've been doing, but when we also pray them, when we use them as a language with which to speak to God. That's what's, I think, the most powerful thing we do here, among the most powerful. We actually ourselves speak to God. That's powerful, in prayer. Various ways of praying the Psalms have been explored, but there is one way which is particularly deep in the tradition of the churches globally. Our Archbishop, Melissa, is especially committed to teaching this way of praying the Psalms, and I'd love for us to join with her in learning this way. We have done some of this before at St. Helens, and it's a very deep way of praying because it involves not only our speaking and our minds, but also our bodies. Again, an insight we reinforced in the spirituality and the brain conversation, that our spiritual practices aren't just ideological or intellectual. They're not just in the brain. They are in the brain and the body as well. We're familiar with a particularly excellent form of body prayer called yoga, all of us, I think, that comes from the Hindu tradition. And when we think of meditative prayer, we tend to think of Buddhism. What many don't realize is that Christianity has ancient disciplines of both body prayer and meditation, which are entirely authentic to us, to Christianity, and they go back millennia. They're not something new. They're well established and old in the early days of our tradition. In my view, our unique traditions of body prayer and meditation began to be forgotten by Christians when we turned our backs on the monasteries, on the monastic life. And that began with a bang, probably for Anglicans, in the 16th century with the abolition of the monasteries, a big event in the Reformation period that's very complicated to talk about, but you might recall that it happened, and we stopped really having a flourishing monastic life. And that might be also when we stopped thinking of Christianity as spiritual. I don't know. And that's something, in my view, we very much need to recover, that way of thinking about ourselves and our faith as spiritual. These resources, though, are still available to us, and praying the Psalms is among the deepest and best. And a sign of that, that these spiritual resources are still available, is that little asterisk found between the halves of psalm verses. This is actually a breath mark. Its purpose is to have us pause. I mean, it has more than one purpose. It could also be to delineate the call and response of psalms. Sometimes there are two choirs that sing them back and forth, or it's cantor and congregation or something like that. But the asterisk is also a breath mark. If you're familiar with the tradition of Gregorian chant of psalms, you'll see that it's a breath mark. And its purpose is to have us pause as we read at that point, shift our attention to our breath, and wait for the breath to return before we proceed. If we do this all together through successive verses, eventually we experience something wonderful in the gradual synchronization of our breathing, and perhaps eventually of our heartbeats. This is of great spiritual importance in spiritual practice, this synchronization, this attention to the breath. It's you all know that I go on retreat to a monastery in the Fraser Valley, Westminster Abbey, where they sing, they chant the Gregorian chant of the office, I think 6 or 7 times a day, and there's a lot of psalm singing there, and they use this practice of the breath, and it's no accident that breath and spirit are the same word. The same word, breath and spirit. We forget that so easily. This watching and synchronizing of the breath is a spiritual practice of great depth, especially when practiced regularly over a period of years, as regular worshipers have always done. And of course, this watching of the breath is in many traditions. You might have, if you take a yoga class, you probably have spent a bit of time with your yoga teacher there watching the breath, or if you've been ever part of Buddhist meditation, it's there too, and it's here for us as well. And we've done it in a very structured way in Christianity. Again, something we explored in Spirituality and the Brain. It may be, in fact, that we cannot do spiritual work at all until we begin to trust, listen to, and follow our breathing. Allowing ourselves to be aware of what our breathing tells us about our spiritual condition now. It's our most reliable barometer of that. So allow me to demonstrate, and then we'll give this approach a try. I hope you'll join me in giving this a try by saying verses 1 through 8 together with this approach to the breath. So if you listen very closely, you'll hear my breaths as well. Happy are they whose way is blameless, who walk in the law of the Lord. Happy are they who observe his decrees and seek him with all their hearts. If you're listening closely, you hear two kinds of breath there. One is the full intake of breath at the beginning and at the asterisk. And the other is that little catch breath between the verses, between who walk in the law of the Lord and happy are they who observe his decrees. There's a thing called a catch breath, which is you keep the intensity, or you keep the through line on the breath, but you let your lungs bounce a little bit. And all singers are familiar with this. We start from a place of the full breath, and then there's that little bounce breath, that little catch breath at a part of the at a break in the phrase. And that's how we build an architecture of phrases using that. And so that's part of this as well. Is that clear for everyone what I'm asking us all to do together? Anyone unclear or have a question? Good. Well, let's take a moment. We'll just be quiet together. And when you hear me take my breath, take 1, 2, and join me, and we'll get synchronized here, and we'll have an opportunity to take the temperature of our spiritual place by paying attention to the breath. And we might find it really shifts our energy. Happy are they whose way is blameless, who walk in the law of the Lord. Happy are they who observe his decrees and seek him with all their hearts, who never do anything wrong, but always walk in his ways. You laid down your commandments that we should fully keep them. Oh, that my ways were made so direct, that I might keep your statutes. Then I should not be put to shame when I regard all your commandments. I will thank you with an unfeigned heart when I have learned your righteous judgments. I will keep your statutes. Do not utterly forsake me.